Good morning and welcome to Sun Sounds of Tucson, Arizona. My name is Alan Jones and I will be reading the news today from the Arizona Daily Star. Today's date is the 5th of February, 2026. Our headlines for today: 700 ICE agents to leave Minnesota. Arizona measure to protect early voting. Sheriff says FBI forwarded ransom note to Savannah Guthrie. And ICE deal will be difficult. Our first story: 700 ICE agents to leave Minnesota. Attribution to Steve Karnowski of the Associated Press. The Trump administration is reducing the number of immigration enforcement officers in Minnesota after state and local officials agreed to cooperate by turning over arrested immigrants, Border Czar Tom Homan said on Wednesday. About 700 federal officers, roughly a quarter of the total deployed around Minnesota, will be withdrawn immediately, Homan said. But Homan did not give a timeline when the operation might end in Minnesota. After weeks of turmoil in the Twin Cities and escalated protests, especially since the killing of protester Alex Apreti, the second fatal shooting by federal officers in Minneapolis. A widespread pullout will only occur after people stop interfering with federal agents carrying out arrests and setting up roadblocks to impede the operations, Homan said. About 2,000 officers will remain in the state after this week's drawdown, he said. Given this increase in unprecedented collaboration and as a result of the need for less public safety officers to do this work and a safer environment, I'm announcing effective immediately we'll draw down 700 people effective today. 700 law enforcement personnel, Homan said during a news conference. He didn't say which jurisdiction have been cooperating with the Department of Homeland Security. Homan said last week that federal officials could reduce the number of federal agents in Minnesota, but only if state and local officials cooperate. His comments came after President Donald Trump seemed to signal a willingness to ease tensions in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Homan had pushed for jails to alert immigration and custom enforcement to inmates who could be deported, saying, "Transferring such inmates to ICE is safer because it means fewer officers have to be out looking for people in the country illegally." The Trump administration has long complained that places known as sanctuary jurisdictions, a term generally applied to a local government that limits law enforcement cooperation with DHS, hinder the arrest of criminal immigrants. Homan said on Wednesday that he thinks the ICE operation in Minnesota has been a success. "Yay, I just listed a bunch of people we took off the streets of the Twin Cities, so I think it's very effective, as far as public safety goes," Homan said. "Was it a perfect operation? No. No. We created one unified chain of command to make sure everybody is on the same page and make sure we follow the rules. I don't think anybody purposely didn't do anything they should not have done." Our next story: Arizona measure to protect early voting. Attribution to Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services. A new initiative seeks to ask Arizona voters whether they want to constitutionally preserve the right used by nearly 90% of them to vote early and even to drop off their ballots on Election Day. A petition drive has been launched by a group calling itself Protect the Vote Arizona, which could put a provision in the Arizona Constitution saying there is a fundamental right to be able to vote early as well as to vote on Election Day. And that, according to Stacey Pearson, whose Lumen Strategies is managing the campaign, includes not just showing up in person to cast a ballot, but also dropping off the ballots that were mailed to their homes. What also would cement into this Constitution is that the right to vote early can be exercised without providing a reason or excuse. Who is behind the campaign is less clear. Pearson has a history of working with Democratic candidates and causes, but she insisted that this is a bipartisan effort. She also would not disclose now who are the leaders of the effort, not who will be funding what could be an expensive campaign to gather the 383,923 valid signatures by July the 2nd to get the issue on the November ballot. Instead, Pearson said, that will have to wait until the group actually starts gathering signatures. But Representative Alexander Kolodin, who is pushing his own contrary measure, said he is well aware of who this progressive far-left organization is and out-of-the-state dark money billionaires backing them. The Scottsdale Republican, however, did not respond to inquiries asking him to provide specifics. Culloden is seeking to get his legislative colleagues to put his own measure on the ballot. One key provision of his HCR 2001 would preserve the right of the legislature to conclude at some future date that there is no right to vote early. That is not a sure thing. In fact, Culloden himself, prior to becoming a legislator, filed an unsuccessful lawsuit on behalf of the Arizona Republican Party, arguing that the Arizona Constitution permits only in-person voting. What his measure definitely would do is end early voting, no later than 7 p.m. on the Friday prior to the election. What's behind that new deadline is the argument that last-minute drop-offs lead to delays in people finding out who actually won. The problem is that early ballots cannot be tabulated until the signatures on the envelopes are verified, and that verification process for what are called late early ballots cannot begin until after Election Day. That's not a problem when there are just a few of those ballots. But in the 2024 general election, there were about 265,000 of these. That includes more than 210,000 in Maricopa County. All that has led to Arizona getting a reputation of being among the last states in the nation, if not the last, to have final election returns. It occurred in 2022 when it took days to confirm that Democrat Katie Hobbs had beaten Republican challenger Carrie Lake, and the situation repeated itself in 2024 when delays in processing ballots left many wondering whether Kamala Harris could have made up her vote deficit against Donald Trump. Kolodin, who is running for Secretary of State, the state's chief election officer, said what is in the newly filed initiative is designed to confuse voters and codify policy that would render Arizona elections less secure, less trustworthy, and less lawful. But Pearson said there is nothing radical about it. This now takes mail-in voting as it currently stands, the windows in which it currently stands, and codifies that in the state constitution, she said. It takes mail-in voting that has worked well in Arizona for decades out of the whim of the legislature, and that includes the right to vote early. That is not a given. In 2022, before he was elected to the House, Kolodin filed suit on behalf of the Arizona Republican Party in an effort to declare early voting illegal. Kolodin, in his legal papers, argued that there is nothing in the state constitution to allow for early voting. He said the only form of voting specifically authorized by framers of the Constitution is in person and on Election Day. And what that means, Kolodin said, is that anything else, including the current system of no-excuse early ballots created by the legislature in 1991 and used by nearly 90% of Arizonans, is illegal. He also presented an alternative legal theory. Kolodin said that at the very least the state was required to return to the way the situation was before 1991. That's when voters could get early ballots, but only if they provided some proof they needed it, like being away from their voting precinct on Election Day, or a physical disability. Those arguments were rebuffed by both a trial judge and the Court of Appeals. What is in the initiative would forever foreclose future efforts to restrict early voting. It also would overturn another law signed in 2021 by then-Governor Doug Ducey, which eliminated the state's permanent early voting list. Prior to that, people who signed up to get a ballot by mail kept getting one until they moved, died, or opted out. The new law said anyone who hasn't used the early ballot in two election cycles would be taken off the list, though they could sign up again. The initiative would overturn that, with a constitutional right of people on the early voting list to keep receiving them for any election for which they are registered, unless they ask to be removed. The voter's registration is cancelled, or the ballot is returned as undeliverable. Culloden's measure is awaiting a final House vote before going to the Senate. If approved there, it would go to voters in November, as the governor has no veto power over what lawmakers put on the ballot. The Protect the Vote Arizona initiatives will be on the ballot if backers get the signatures and it survives expected legal challenges. Culloden dismissed the chances of competition with his own plan. Republicans in Arizona are unfazed by the astroturfed efforts to groups like this to confuse voters and codify policy that would render Arizona's elections less secure, less trustworthy, and less lawful, he said in a prepared statement. Culloden did not respond to follow-up questions about exactly what he believes is in the initiative that does any of that. In both measures are on the ballot and are approved, sections of each that do not conflict with each other would take effect, but where both cannot coexist, the proposal that gets more votes would take precedent. Our next story. Sheriff says FBI forwarded ransom note to Savannah Guthrie. Attribution to Norma Cole and Catalina E. Birch of the Arizona Daily Star. Investigators analyzed a ransom note received on Monday by a Tucson news station and are taking it seriously, Pima County Sheriff Chris Nanos told CBS News on Tuesday afternoon. CBS said Nanos told the network the FBI received the note and made the decision to share it with Savannah Guthrie. The note was sent to the station after the disappearance of Nancy Guthrie, the mother of Savannah, the host of NBC's Today Show. Nanos has said investigators believe the 84-year-old was abducted from her Tucson home near North Campbell Avenue and East Skyline Drive Saturday night or Sunday morning. CBS said the note, which the station received on Monday and agreed not to report on, contained specific details about the home and what Nancy Guthrie was wearing that night, according to Nanos, although he would not confirm the accuracy of that information or the legitimacy of the note. The note was received by KOLD News 13, the CBS affiliate in Tucson, according to a social media post on Tuesday afternoon by its evening anchor Mary Coleman. Authorities had hoped to keep the information from becoming public, but the note was obtained by TMZ, which reported on it before contacting the sheriff's office, CBS said. Nanos told the network. A spokesman for Nanos said the sheriff was not available to confirm the CBS report. TMZ, a tabloid entertainment news website controversial for paying for tips, reported on Tuesday that it was sent an alleged and unverified ransom note Tuesday, demanding millions to be paid in Bitcoin in return for Guthrie's release. TMC said it forwarded the note to the Pima County Sheriff. Shortly after TMZ's posting, Nanos' office had said on social media only that it was aware of reports circulating about possible ransom notes, adding, "Anything that comes in goes directly to our detectives who are coordinating with the FBI." At a press conference a couple of hours before that, Nanos had said, when asked about any ransom notes, "We're following all leads, that's all I can tell you. I'm not going to get into all of that." He also was asked then for any updates on whether Guthrie might have been targeted because of her daughter's Savannah. "We don't know. We're going to assume both sides of that, for investigative purposes, he said. Nanas told the New York Times on Tuesday night that he has spoken with Savannah Guthrie and her security team, and they are not aware of any previous threats to her or her family. Savannah, who was raised in Tucson and is a University of Arizona graduate, was here late last year filming segments that introduced Today Show viewers to her hometown. In a written statement on Tuesday afternoon, Nanas officers listed these updates. DNA. Detectives collected DNA samples from the home that have been confirmed to belong to Nancy. At this time, the sheriff has not confirmed whether those samples were blood. He has stated that he does not want to get into any specific details about evidence in order to protect the integrity of the investigation. Possible injuries. The sheriff has spoken in general terms and stated in multiple interviews that, based on circumstances at the home, detectives believe Mrs. Guthrie was taken against her will, possibly in the middle of the night. At this time, we do not have any information to share regarding possible injuries. Pacemaker. Detectives are working through any data that may be available. The New York Times reported investigators are working with the company that manufactured Guthrie's pacemaker to see if any helpful information can be gathered from it remotely. Cameras. Mrs. Guthrie's home has several cameras. Detectives are working with the respective companies to determine the number of cameras and whether any footage is available. Suspects. At this point, no suspects have been identified in this case. Detectives are continuing to speak with anyone who may have come into contact with Mrs. Guthrie. The statement was issued after Nanas fielded questions at a press conference on Tuesday, the third day of the investigation. Guthrie, who lives alone, was reported missing at about noon on Sunday after she failed to show up at church. She was last seen Saturday about 9:30 p.m. when a family member dropped her off after dinner and made sure she was safely inside before leaving, Nanas said. Nanas told the New York Times authorities have spoken with family members and all have been cooperative. In a new interview with NBC's national correspondent Liz Kreutz that aired on the Today Show Wednesday, Sheriff Nanas said investigators are hopeful that Nancy Guthrie is alive. "We have nothing else to go on but the belief that she is here," he told Kreutz. "She's present, she's alive, and we want to save her." In an earlier interview with the New York Times, Nanas said that Guthrie had dinner with her daughter, Annie, and son-in-law, Tommaso Sione, Saturday. Nanas told the Times that Sione dropped Guthrie off at home and made sure she was inside safely before leaving. Our next story. Ice deal will be difficult. Attribution to Marie-Claire Jelonek and Joey Capoletti of the Associated Press. Despite rare negotiations between Democrats and President Donald Trump, a bipartisan agreement on new restrictions for federal immigration enforcement in the next 2 weeks will be exceedingly difficult, or even an impossibility, as Republican Senate Majority Leader John Thune said. Congress is discussing potential new rules for immigration and custom enforcement and U.S. Customs and Border Protection, after officers shot and killed two Minneapolis protesters in January. The negotiations come amid some bipartisan sentiment that Congress should step in to de-escalate tensions over the enforcement operations that have rocked Minnesota and other states. President Donald Trump last week agreed to a Democratic request that funding for the Department of Homeland Security be separated from a larger spending bill and extended at a current level for 2 weeks while the two parties discuss possible requirements for the federal agents. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, said this weekend that he was at the White House when Trump spoke with Senate Democratic leaders Chuck Schumer of New York and that they were on the path to get agreement. But it's unclear if the president or enough congressional Republicans will agree to any of the Democrats' larger demands that the officers unmask and identify themselves obtain judicial warrants in certain cases, and work with local authorities. House GOP lawmakers are demanding that some of their own priorities be added to the Homeland Security spending bill, including legislation that would require proof of citizenship before Americans register to vote. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham and other Republican senators are pushing for restrictions on sanctuary cities that they don't say do enough to crack down on illegal immigration. There's no clear definition of sanctuary jurisdictions, but the term is generally applied to states and local governments that limit cooperation with federal immigration authorities. It's also uncertain if Democrats, who are furious over the Trump administration's increasingly aggressive immigration enforcement operations, would be willing to compromise. We don't need promises, we need laws, Schumer said, adding that Democrats would present Republicans with a serious, detailed proposal soon. A look at Democrats' demands and what Republicans are saying about them. Agreements on body cameras. Republicans say they are open to officers wearing body cameras, a change that was already in the underlying Homeland Security spending bill. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem backed that up on Monday when she ordered body-worn cameras to be issued to every Homeland Security officer on the ground in Minneapolis, including those from ICE. She said the policy would expand nationwide as funding becomes available. The bill already directed $20 million to outfit immigration enforcement agents with body-worn cameras. Gil Kerlowski, who served as Commissioner of U.S. Customs and Border Protection from 2014 to 2017, said that most agents are very supportive of cameras because they could help exonerate officers. But he added that complex questions remain, including when footage should be released and when cameras must be activated. When do you turn it on? And if you got into a problem and didn't have it on, are you going to be disciplined? It's really pretty complex, he said. Schumer said on Tuesday that the body cameras need to stay on. As videos and photographs of aggressive immigration tactics and high-profile shootings circulate nationwide, agents covering their faces with masks have become a flashpoint. Democrats argue that removing the masks would increase accountability. Republicans warn it could expose agents to harassment and threats. State law enforcement, local folks don't do it, said Representative Benny Thompson, the top Democrat on the Committee for Homeland Security. I mean, what's so special about an ICE law enforcement agent that they have to wear masks? But Republicans appear unlikely to agree. Unlike your local law enforcement in your homeland, ICE agents are being doxxed and targeted. We have evidence of that, Johnson said on Tuesday. He added that if you unmask them and you put all of their identifying information on their uniform, they will obviously be targeted. Immigration officers are already required to identify themselves as soon as it is practical and safe to do so, according to federal regulations. ICE officials insist those rules are being followed. Critics, however, question how closely officers adhere to the regulations. We just see routinely that that's not happening, said Nithyan Nathan Pinheiro, a policy attorney with the Immigrant Legal Resource Center. Any deal Democrats strike on the Department of Homeland Security is unlikely to satisfy everyone in the party. Representative Anaya Presley of Massachusetts said she should never support an agreement that didn't require unmasking. I ran for Congress in 2018 on Abolish ICE, Presley said. My position has not changed. Thune of South Dakota has repeatedly said that it is an impossibility to negotiate and pass something so complicated in 2 weeks. He said any talks should be between Democrats and Trump. I don't think this is very realistic, Thune said Tuesday, about finding quick agreement, but there's always miracles, right? We will now move on to the Tucson and region news. Our first story. Pima County supervisors to consider anti-ICE measures. Attribution to Charles Borla of the Arizona Daily Star. Supervisors approved exploring two ordinances aimed at prohibiting Pima County property being used by federal immigration agents and banning law enforcement officials from wearing masks. The board also approved a resolution on Tuesday opposing the proposed immigration detention center in Marana. The vote on the two ICE measures, both requested by Supervisors Jen Allen, the board chair, direct county officials to craft them for a future vote. The board voted 4-1 to move ahead with the two measures, which are expected to be released later this month and are expected to be voted on in March. The supervisors also approved the resolution opposing the Marana ICE facility by a 4-1 vote. Supervisor Steve Christie, the lone Republican on the board, was the sole no vote on all three issues. The first ordinance would bar county-owned property from being used for federal immigration enforcement purposes, similar to an ordinance that the Tucson City Council is looking to pass in the near future. Allen said she requested the board look into such ordinances because residents in the community are under the threat of immigration agents, which she called an assault on people, safety, and people's dignity. Right now, our community is struggling. Struggling whether to go to school, whether to go to church, to get medical care. These are things that are the antithesis of what we are as a body seeks to create within our community. We need our community to feel safe, she said. County-owned spaces should be places that are safe. Safe for people to escape from, find some respite against the terror that we're seeking out on our streets and in the streets across this country. Supervisor Andres Canos said fear of ICE raids is spreading across the community, changing the way people live and where they go. Pima County is a property owner. We have the legal authority to set rules on county property. We have the authority to protect access to services, to protect our county employees, and the authorities to keep public spaces calm and functional, Cano said. Our buildings are not traps. Our parks are not ambush sites. Our health clinics are not places of fear, and our libraries are not places people should avoid. They are public spaces. They belong to the public and to everyone, Supervisor Rex Scott said. Protecting the public's health and safety is one of our most solemn and necessary duties, which was why he voted for them. These are not the worst of the worst people. People are finding that their neighbors, their friends, are being detained. This isn't what was promised, he said. Going back to that solemn and necessary change of protecting public health and safety that we are obliged to take on as supervisors. I cannot countenance the idea of federal immigration officials operating, staging any of their activities on county property. Christie said a key element that has been ignored was the very intense subject of enforcement of the proposed ordinance being weighed. What we are going to do, send in Tucson Police Department to draw their guns and fight? Is that what we're going to do? Is that what we're asking? Christie said, with some of the audience responded by yelling yes, while others cheered or applauded. Are we asking for the Sheriff's Department to arm themselves up and go in and fight ICE with guns? Christie asked, which again prompted many of the crowd to respond yes. This is really a highly volatile issue that's been perpetuated by this board without thinking it thoroughly through. And if there is any violence after this ordinance is passed, it'll be on the hands of my colleagues. If you're asking for some sort of a civil insurrection, a violent one, you're treading on very dangerous territory. And I think you know that, he said, speaking to the other four supervisors. This is a lot of show, but it is also a lot of danger to it. because now you're going to be instructing other law enforcement agencies to physically battle with ICE. Supervisor Matt Heinz, his response, said he has full faith and confidence in local law enforcement that they are here to de-escalate these kinds of situations, to protect county residents, while also making sure that violence is something that does not happen. Scott, also in response to Christie's objections, said that while nobody has the right or ability to impede a federal operation, the county board has the right, the ability, and the duty to safeguard county property, which is all the proposed ordinance is calling for. Local governments around the country have taken this kind of action. This is nothing novel or new, but it is something that is abundantly necessary because of what we are seeing coming out of the federal government, Scott said. The other ordinance county staff was directed to craft would ban law enforcement officers at the city, county, and state and federal level from wearing masks while on the job, and require all law enforcement officers to wear visible identification according to the items requested by Allen. Christie offered in a substitute motion that the county craft an ordinance that would ban the public from revealing law enforcement officers' private and personal information at the city, county, state, and federal levels, otherwise known as doxing, while also requiring officers to wear identification. Though it failed to gain traction, Scott did acknowledge the risks of doxing that Christie spoke of, saying that nobody should never be painted with too broad a brush. Nobody, because of their public role, deserves to have people showing up at their home, threatening their families and endangering their children. We're talking about a failure of leadership when it comes to the actions of some of the DHS agencies, Scott said. We're not talking about the actions of rank-and-file people, some of whom have devoted their careers to law enforcement, many of whom are our constituents. I would ask that all of us keep our tactics and our intentions in mind when we are responding to what is a failure of leadership from the Trump administration, not a failure of the actions of the rank-and-file officer. The resolution passed by the board formally opposes the proposed ICE detention center in Marana. The former Arizona State Prison on Marana, which was the state's first private prison until Arizona bought the facility in 2013 from Centerville, Utah-based Management and Training Corporation, MTC, which already runs five ICE detention centers in California and Texas, bought back the prison last year for $15 million and informed the Marana Town Council that the facility may be used as an ICE detention center, which has since brought harsh pushback from the public. Allen said, "It's important for the board to take a stand on behalf of residents that we do not want this for our community. It is essential that this facility is not warehousing our loved ones, our neighbors, our patients, our students, our employees," she said. "There is much, I think, that we can do to try to stop this detention center. I think we, as the board, need to do all that we can to try to stop this sort of warehousing and inhumanity and denigration of our friends and family members." Scott asked if the county has any regulatory or legal authority that could prevent such a detention facility, as it is Marana's jurisdiction. Sam Brown, a deputy county attorney, said the office is looking into public nuisance laws for potential legal authority. Our next story. GOP primary race to be Arizona's election chief might grow. Attribution to Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services. A potentially heated race is shaping up among Republicans who want to take on incumbent Democratic Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fuentes. Gina Swoboda, who just stepped down as chair of the Arizona Republican Party, filed a statement of intent Tuesday to be the GOP nominee to become the state's chief elections officer. That filing allows Swoboda to begin gathering signatures to have her name on the August 4th GOP primary ballot. but whether Swoboda intends to take on State Representative Alexander Kaludin remains in question. Exploring my options, she said in a statement to Capital Media Services. Elections has always been a passion for me, Swoboda said. I love that office. Swoboda worked in that office under both Republican Michael Reagan and Democrat Katie Hobbs. Aside from running the state party for 2 years before quitting last month, Swoboda also was a policy advisor for the state house. In October, she announced plans to run for the U.S. House after Republican Congressman David Schweikert said he was vacating that seat in a bid to run for governor. That district includes parts of North Phoenix, Scottsdale, and Fountain Hills. Swoboda also got the backing of President Trump in that bid. Kaludin, for his part, dismissed the possibility of having to wage a primary race. He even said that Swoboda, before her latest move, endorsed his bid for a Secretary of State. I'm the most qualified candidate in the race, and the voters know it, Kaludin told Capital Media Services. And he said there's a good reason for her not to abandon her congressional bid. Gina should focus on her CD1 primary so that she isn't the reason Republicans lose the U.S. House majority, Kaludin said. The move also drew the ire of Senator Jake Hoffman. The Queen Creek Republican is chair of the Arizona Freedom Caucus, of which Kaludin is a member. Gina Swoboda is a Democrat, he said. Hoffman also accused her of attacking school choice. That stems from the fact that Swoboda, as chair of the Arizona Republican Party, said there needs to be more guardrails around the state voucher program, which provides tax dollars for parents to send their children to private and parochial schools and to homeschool their children. Swoboda cited reports of parents buying items like lingerie, jewelry, and home appliances and said there needs to be protections against abuse. Our next story. Judge, skeptical of Pentagon's punishment of Senator Kelly. Attribution to Michael Kunzelman of the Associated Press. A federal judge said Tuesday that he knows of no U.S. Supreme Court precedent to justify the Pentagon's censuring of a sitting U.S. senator who joined a videotaped plea for troops to resist unlawful orders from the Trump administration. Senator Mark Kelly had a front-row seat in a courtroom as his attorneys urged U.S. District Judge Richard Leon to block the Pentagon from punishing the Arizona Democrat, a retired U.S. Navy pilot. Leon didn't immediately rule from the bench on Kelly's claims that the Pentagon's officials violated his First Amendment's free speech rights. But the judge appeared to be skeptical of key arguments that a government attorney made in defense of Kelly's January 5th censure from Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. You're asking me to do something the Supreme Court has never done, the judge told Justice Department Attorney John Bailey. Isn't that a bit of a stretch? Bailey argued that Congress decided that retired military service members are subject to the same uniform code of military justice that applies to active duty troops. Retirees are part of the armed forces, Bailey said. They are not separated from the services. Benjamin Miser, one of Kelly's lawyers, said they aren't aware of any ruling to support the notion that military retirees have diminished speech rights, and he argued that the First Amendment clearly protects Kelly's speech in this case, and any other approach would be to make new law, Miser added. Leon, who was nominated to the bench by the Republican President George W. Bush, said the Pentagon's actions against Kelly could have a chilling effect on many, many other retirees who wish to voice their opinion. Our next story. Man could avoid more prison time in Navajo woman's disappearance. Attribution to Savannah Peters of the Associated Press. A man charged in connection with the 2021 disappearance of a Navajo woman pleaded guilty last week to robbery, marking the latest turn in a case that has been emblematic of the epidemic of killings and disappearances in Native American communities. Preston Henry Tolth appeared before a federal judge in Phoenix. Tolth, who has been in custody since 2023, will not spend any additional time in prison if the court accepts the terms of the plea agreement reached with prosecutors. Prosecutors allege that Tolth assaulted Ella May Begay, stole her Ford F-150 pickup truck, and drove it across state lines. In the plea agreement, he admitted to punching Begay in the face several times and leaving her on the side of the road before selling her truck for money and drugs. Begay's case helped bring national attention to the high rate of violence faced by Native people, providing fuel for tribal leaders and victim advocates as they continued pushing for law enforcement resources and more cooperation for investigations across jurisdictional lines. There have been marches, listening sessions, and congressional hearings in recent years, and federal authorities have funneled more investigations and prosecutions to field officers in key locations around the United States in hopes of solving cases and prosecuting offenders. Still, Begay has never been found, and her family remains heartbroken. Known in her community as a master rug weaver, Begay lived in a Sweetwater, Arizona town on the Navajo Nation, not far from the Four Corners Monument. Our next story. Guthrie case rattles community. Attribution to Elvia Verdugo of the Arizona Daily Star. As cyclists, dog walkers, delivery drivers, and a school bus went through a Catalina Foothills neighborhood on Tuesday afternoon, the day seemed like any other. But for community members and the neighbors of Nancy Guthrie, who law enforcement believes was abducted from her home near North Campbell Avenue and East Skyline Drive this weekend, almost everything has changed for the neighborhood they call home. Neighbors say they're shocked, scared, and anxious since police and searchers swarmed into the neighborhood to search for Guthrie, 84, who was reported missing on Sunday afternoon. Guthrie is a mother of Savannah Guthrie, a host on NBC's Today Show. "We just can't believe this is our quiet little neighborhood, and you know everyone's out walking their dogs and just taking walks. But things have changed," says Ruth Dunshee, a neighbor. Dunshee and her husband, Kurt, were both at home the night of the disappearance. They say they didn't notice anything out of the ordinary until the next day, when members of the Pima County Sheriff's Department came knocking on their door. They said she, Guthrie, was missing, and they asked if we had any camera footage, which we don't, and they told us a little bit about what happened, and we were shocked, Beth Dunshee said. Upon hearing about her neighbor's disappearance, Beth Dunshee knew something was very wrong. Beth Dunshee says she talked to Guthrie a few times over the years as they would run into each other while walking through the neighborhood. But she hasn't seen her in a few years since Guthrie's mobility issues prevented her from going on long walks. "I knew that she could not walk well," she said. "I was like, she could not have gone far. She would never have gone walking away at midnight." The Dunshees say they don't have a home camera system, but with Guthrie's abduction so close to home, they plan on getting one soon. Pima County Sheriff Chris Nanos said he does not believe the public is in any danger. However, Nanos' statement isn't a comfort to those who live in the area. "They do not know yet," Kurt Dunshee said, "and therefore we can't make an assessment of whether we're at risk because we don't really know what happened." George Fantry, who lives up the road, has lived in the Catalina Foothills neighborhood for nearly 10 years. Throughout his time in there, he says he's never seen anything happen. He described the neighborhood as a place that has the feel of being able to leave your doors unlocked. Fantry says he was shocked when he heard about the abduction. "You get anxious about it happening in your neighborhood," Fantry said. "How could this happen in your neighborhood? I know most people would say this would be a very safe and quiet neighborhood. It's the way we view it. That's a bit scary that could happen around the corner from where you live." Over the last couple of days, Fantry says he's felt terrible and like he couldn't do anything about it for anyone. On Monday, the 67-year-old who completes daily walks around the neighborhood, went on a 5-mile walk around the area to see if he noticed anything out of the ordinary. I figured I could at least look, he said. I have 2 eyes and 2 legs and I like to walk. So I figured, well, I'm going to go out there and walk around and look in the washes and see if I notice anything different, because I'm out here every day. Despite feeling anxious about the abduction, Fantry says he still feels safe in the neighborhood. Right now, he's feeling more concerned for Guthrie and her family, including daughter Savannah. Neighbor Deborah Perry was on her afternoon run Tuesday as she passed the Guthrie house. As reporters asked her to chat, it was the first time she had learned of the seriousness of the situation. I just learned about the severity of this, she said. I understand it, considered an abduction, and that there are some findings that warrant that. That's much more disturbing to me than thinking that she got lost or something. Perry, who has lived in the neighborhood for 10 years, says the Guthrie abduction doesn't make her feel any different about feeling safe in the area. Most of us who walk have dogs or whatever we walk all around here, she said, of the neighborhood. Most of us say hello to one another. It's not very trafficked here. People drive by and they usually wave. Although Perry doesn't know Guthrie, she says she's sympathetic about the situation. Perry was just one of a handful of neighbors who were on a late afternoon walk on Tuesday, while some were walking throughout the neighborhood as part of their daily routine. Others were curious about the Guthrie house. Laurel Brantley was out walking her dog as she made it to the edge of the area where local and national media were stationed on Tuesday. Brantley decided to walk around the neighborhood to gauge the proximity between her house and the Guthrie house, which turned out to be less than 1/2 mile. As she made her way toward the area, the PCSD helicopter could be seen and heard circling the Guthrie house. They made several laps around the house and the surrounding area for 30 minutes. The helicopter was how Brantley discovered that Guthrie was missing a couple of days ago. The helicopter was flying so close and low to her house that the windows began rattling, she says. The noise prompted her to look up what was going on. She saw the missing person report and immediately felt scared, she said. I feel nervous about it because someone could do it to anyone, Brantley said, adding, I feel like we need all the security systems now. Brantley has lived in the neighborhood for a couple of years and says her neighbors are super kind people who have given her a peace of mind about living in this neighborhood. But knowing how close this incident is to her home, Brantley no longer feels comfortable walking by herself at night. Uncertainty now lingers in what once felt like a quiet and safe area for residents, as law enforcement searches for answers as to what happened to Guthrie. Her neighbors continue to grapple with feeling fearful, all while trying to maintain hope that their neighbor will be safely returned. I understand that she's related to Savannah, but that's kind of beside the point in my mind, Brantley said. It's someone's mom and grandma. We will now move on to the nation and world news. Our first story. Gabbard says Trump requested her presence. Attribution to Eric Tucker of the Associated Press. Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard told lawmakers in a letter Monday that she attended an FBI search of the elections hub in Fulton County, Georgia, last week because President Donald Trump asked for her to be there. She also acknowledged that she facilitated what she described as a brief phone call between Trump and FBI agents who carried out the search but claimed that neither she nor the president issued directives. The letter to top Democrats on the House and Senate Intelligence Committee marked Gabbard's first detailed explanation for her unusual presence at an FBI search during which agents armed with warrants seized hundreds of boxes containing ballots and other documents related to the 2020 election in Georgia's most populous county. Fulton County, which votes overwhelmingly Democratic, is a frequent target of the president's ire. he long insisted, without evidence, that widespread voter fraud in the county cost him victory to Georgia in his 2020 loss to Democrat Joe Biden. Gabbard's arrival in Georgia raised immediate questions among Democratic officials because the FBI search of the election center was a law enforcement, not intelligence activity, and because the position of the National Intelligence Director is typically focused on foreign threats rather than domestic concerns. In her letter, Gabbard said Trump specifically requested her presence and she accompanied senior FBI officials under my broad statutory authority to coordinate, integrate, and analyze intelligence related to election security. Gabbard has been central to Trump administration's effort to cast doubt on intelligence community's conclusion of Russia's interference on Trump's behalf during his successful 2016 campaign. Democrats fear her presence in Georgia is laying the groundwork for the federal government to assert that the 2020 race he lost was somehow tainted by foreign meddling or to cast doubt on the integrity of future elections. In her letter, Gabbard suggested that election systems are at risk of foreign interference, citing what she said was intelligence showing that electronic voting systems have been vulnerable to exploitation that could result in the manipulation of votes. She said, "To preserve the integrity of our elections, we must understand whether there has been foreign or other malign interference in our elections, and whether vulnerabilities exist in our election infrastructure that could be exploited in future elections." She did not explain why Fulton County was singled out for scrutiny, saying she didn't see the warrant that investigators submitted to a judge for approval. Audits, state officials, courts, and Trump's own former attorney general rejected the idea that there was widespread fraud in the 2020 election that could have altered the outcome. The 2024 election that Trump won was also seen relatively trouble-free at the polls. Gabbard also confirmed a report earlier Monday from the New York Times that she helped arrange a call between Trump and FBI agent. It is rare for a president to communicate directly with rank-and-file FBI personnel about specific investigations. While visiting the FBI field office in Atlanta, I thank the FBI agents for their professionalism and great work, and facilitated a brief phone call for the president to thank the agents personally for their work. He did not ask any questions, nor did he or I issue any directives, she wrote. Our next story. How bomb cyclones form. Attribution to Isabella O'Malley of the Associated Press. When turbulent weather with whipping winds and heavy snow is in the forecast, meteorologists sometimes warn that a storm could bomb out or become a bomb cyclone. But what exactly does that mean? According to the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, certain storms undergo bomb genesis, which happens when a storm's central pressure drops at least 24 millibars in 24 hours. These storms are sometimes called bomb cyclones. Storm intensity is measured by central pressure. So the lower the pressure, the stronger the storm. Such rapidly strengthening storms are capable of producing heavy rain, blizzard conditions, and intense winds that can create dangerous conditions such as downed trees and power outages. If you're watching TV at night and the weather report comes on and you're hearing bomb cyclone being used, that usually means that there's quite a bit of active weather going on, said Andrew Orison, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in College Park, Maryland. Bomb cyclones can happen in any season, but mainly occur in the fall and winter, when frigid air from the Arctic can creep south and clash with warmer air masses. It's really the clash of those air masses that really kind of helps to generate the area of low pressure, in the first place, Orison said. Regions in North America that are prone to seeing bomb cyclones, including Alaska, the Pacific Northwest, and the Great Lakes region. Our next story. Election 2026. GOP outpaces Dems in 2025 fundraising. Attribution to the Associated Press. The Republican National Committee vastly outpaced Democrats in the crush for cash ahead of the midterm elections, holding a nearly $100 million advantage at the close of 2025, according to year-end filings to the Federal Elections Commission. As Democrats struggled in the Trump era, the RNC raised $172 million in 2025, with $95 million cash on hand at year's end. In contrast, the Democratic National Committee posted $145 million for the year, with $14 million on hand and $17 million in debt to start the new year underwater. It points to a turbulent election cycle ahead as President Donald Trump fights political headwinds that tend to brush back the party in power, in this case, Republican control of the White House and both chambers of Congress, and reward challengers during the midterms. In the campaigns for control of Congress, the total hauls are less stark. House Republicans posted one of their strongest years, raising $13 million in the last month of the year, to close with more than $117 million for the National Republican Congressional Committee, the main campaign arm. House Democrats trailed slightly at $115 million. Both the House committees started 2026 with about $50 million cash on hand, according to the filings, which were due to the FEC this week. A similar dynamic is playing out in the Senate. House Speaker Mike Johnson said on Sunday the GOP's overall fundraising haul left him bullish on the party's chances to not only hold on to their razor-thin majority in the House, but grow it with more members. "We're going to have a war chest to run on," Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, said on Fox News on Sunday. The fundraising totals reflect the 2025 calendar year before the onslaught of actions and events that scramble the nation's politics in the first months of the new year. From the U.S. military attack on Venezuela to the shooting deaths of two American protesters, the Trump administration's immigration enforcement actions in Minneapolis, it's not all certain whether voters and donors will undergo lasting shifts in their attitudes towards the political party. This brings us to the end of today's broadcast of the Arizona Daily Star. This is Alan Jones signing off.